Hello and welcome to today's episode of The Quad Shot, where we help you down and digest the day's most pertinent cancer news. It's January 6, 2020. Welcome to a new year, and welcome to the Quadcast. We've got lots in store for the new year, and with that being said, let's dive in. First up, shake your tail feather. While consensus contouring guidelines for spine radiosurgery have been at our disposal for years, the sacrum hasn't garnered much love. And that could be because only 5% of spine metastases wind up there. But it's worth noting the anatomic and functional distinctions from its superior brethren, namely a lack of intervertebral disc space that not only precludes mobility, but may also mean the sacrum lacks analogous barriers to disease spread. Luckily, in 2020, you no longer have to guess if you're treating the sacrum right. Experts from 9 high-volume centers across the U.S., Canada, and South Korea convened to bring us these consensus guidelines, as published in the Green Journal 2020 by Dunn et al. They focus on sacral radiosurgery targets specifically. And in all honesty, you've really just got to look at the examples, as the CTVs may be more detailed than you might think. They also recommend drawing the thecal sac all the way down to the tip of the tailbone to include all nerve rootlets, in addition to drawing the lumbosacral nerve roots. All of this is with the goal of avoiding ill-placed hotspots. So what's the bottom line? These guidelines can help you draw anatomically savvy sacral radiosurgery targets. Up second, Wham-Pam. While some women with early stage ER-positive breast cancer receive cytotoxic chemotherapy, those with metastatic disease receive endocrine therapy and CDK4/6 inhibitors. And in some ways, that just doesn't seem right. The Coraline trial, as published in Lancet Oncology 2019 by Pratt et al., was a randomized phase 2 trial where postmenopausal women with local regional ERPR-positive, HER2-negative breast cancer received either neoadjuvant chemotherapy, ACT, or letrozole and ribociclib for 6 months. Now, central to this study was the PAM50 molecular profiling test used to assign molecular subtypes, and all enrollees had to have luminal B breast cancer. The PAM50 test also generates a risk of recurrence score that estimates the risk of distant recurrence at 10 years without chemotherapy. None of the enrolled patients had a low risk of recurrence at enrollment, and roughly 85% had a high risk of recurrence. Here's where things get really novel. The primary outcome was the proportion of patients converted to a low risk of recurrence score after neoadjuvant therapy. This could be considered quote-unquote molecular downstaging, as opposed to the more conventional pathologic downstaging, which is a known challenge in ERPR-positive breast cancer. At surgery, nearly half, at 46%, of patients in each group were molecularly downstaged to a low risk of recurrence score, while 21 to 22% still had a high risk of recurrence score. In other words, a similar rate of molecular downstaging was achieved with chemotherapy-free targeted therapy regimen that had less toxicity. As you can see, the ultimate challenge in unseating chemotherapy for early stage disease is establishing surrogate outcomes that are both meaningful and feasibly measured in clinical trials. The bottom line is, neoadjuvant letrozole and ribociclib achieve similar results of molecular downstaging as cytotoxic chemotherapy for women with luminal B, breast cancer. Up next, pro bono. It's a rare Twitter scroll that doesn't include some iteration of a photon versus proton debate these days. Usually comes down to the theoretical advantages on one hand and the lack of hard data on the other. And to be fair, detecting differences in long-term toxicity takes a long time. Here, we have a large retrospective comparison published in JAMA Oncology 2019 by Bauman et al. That looked at clinical outcomes within 90 days of treatment with photons versus protons, concurrent with chemotherapy for any locally advanced cancer treated at the University of Pennsylvania from 2011 to 2016. As expected, there was a significantly lower integral dose with photons and no difference in disease outcomes. Intriguingly, though, on propensity score matched analysis, there was indeed a statistically lower rate of grade 2+ and especially grade 3+ toxicities after proton therapy. And what's more, there was half the risk of performance status decline, hazard ratio of 0.51. As an accompanying editorial points out, despite the pristine methodology of the authors, there remain unaccounted selection biases, including healthcare literacy and even cancer type. For example, only 10% of those in the proton arm were treated for head and neck cancer, compared to 36% in the photon arm. They close with a practical call for enrollment on phase 3 trials, a goal that would be made much more feasible by the support of the payers who call for them. The bottom line is, retrospective clinical data suggests proton therapy confers lower risk of toxicity with equal efficacy compared to photon therapy. But ultimately, we, and by we, I mean insurers, will need phase 3 data. Up next, fair play. If you couldn't quite make it through the entire ROAPM proposal, this article in the Journal of Oncology Practice 2019 by Thacker is here to help. While the ROAPM is well-intentioned, these authors suggest the proposed incentives may have missed their mark. For example, disease site-specific bundled payment calculations currently include palliative intent and partially completed treatments, dropping the estimated average payment by 4 to 6% across all 17 disease sites. Second, and you can either follow their excruciatingly simplified payment calculations or just trust them, as we did, historic reimbursements are hugely influential, and not in the way that you might assume. Historic reimbursements are somewhat practice-specific, so practices who more commonly employ hypofractionation and other resource-efficient treatments will have their bundled payments adjusted down, while those still treating prostate cancer over, let's say, 9 weeks will have theirs adjusted up. Finally, there is an automatic 4 to 5% slash, which is more than that of the oncology care model, in reimbursements across the board, with an opportunity to earn back only professional, not technical, fees. The bottom line is, logical input from actual radiation oncologists into the ROAPM can increase equity, encourage participation, and help realize its overarching goal of delivering quality cancer care. Next up, take the L. So is there a difference between PD-1 and PD-L1 inhibitors? Well, obviously there is, but what about when it comes to treatment outcomes? Well, it's kind of hard to say, since they never really go up against one another on study. This systematic review and meta-analysis published in JAMA Oncology 2019 by Duan asks just this question. Across 19 prospective trials, randomizing greater than 11,000 patients to an inhibitor of PD-1 or PD-L1, versus something else, anti-PD-1 inhibitors conferred superior progression-free and even overall survival. This advantage with PD-1 inhibitors persisted across sensitivity analyses. Why the difference? Well, ultimately we don't know, but one thought is that blocking PD-1 blocks all its interactions, whereas blocking PD-L1 still allows for PD-1 to bind to PD-L2, which, yes, apparently that's a thing. The bottom line is, anti-PD-1 may work better than anti-PD-L1 agents. Up next, golden rule. We at the Quad Shot want to promote that others do what you would feel safe doing yourself. This quick and dirty analysis, published in JAMA Network Open 2019 by Pagato, looked at three of the largest gyms in the U.S., Anytime Fitness, Gold's Gym, and Planet Fitness. And it revealed that the less than 2,000 locations sampled house more than 4,600 tanning beds, which, if you ask us, is not quite the picture of fitness the medical community can really get behind. Finally, chemo a la carte. Women with breast cancer love to be proactive about their health, but sometimes measures to diminish side effects can diminish treatment efficacy. A prospective correlative study published in JCO 2019 by Ambrozone et al. Looked at women receiving ACT chemotherapy for breast cancer on SWOG S0221, and it demonstrated concerningly large associations with the use of antioxidants, iron, and or vitamin B12 with increased risk of recurrence and even death. The bottom line is, taking mega doses of antioxidants during chemotherapy for breast cancer may actually increase the risk of cancer recurrence and death. This concludes today's episode of The Quad Shot. If you like what you've heard, please consider giving us a 5-star rating and subscribing to our podcast. Also, check out our website at www.quadshotnews.com and subscribe to our newsletter. We'll catch you next time.